You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Joe Crawford.
And I'm Don Guerra. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, February 21st. 2017. We hear about two pieces of legislation that would affect food stamp policy in Indiana later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we hear about resources for senior citizens who become socially isolated. That's on Everyday People, a weekly segment aimed at improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County. But first, these local headlines.
Indiana students could eventually be sitting for a new standardized test. It's called iLearn, and it would replace the current decades-old iStep. House Bill 1003, proposing the new exam, passed through the Indiana House yesterday with a vote of 67 to 31. It requires that students in grades 3 through 8 take a standardized exam. Students in grade 9 through 12 would take an end-of-course assessment at least once a year. In 2015, President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, requiring students to take some type of standardized test. But not everyone feels that this new exam is the solution to effective assessments. Monroe County Community School Corporation School Board member Sue Wanser has another strategy in mind.
I think if we're going to do some kind of statewide standardized test, we need as a state to decide what the purpose of that test is and what the goal for the results are, and then design a test to fit that.
Wanser goes on to say that learning in the classroom should be assessed by teachers. She also says the test creates a problem directly related to a school's economic demographics.
For a lot of us, we know that standardized testing like that really is testing poverty in our schools. Schools with high poverty don't do as well. Schools with low poverty do much better.
And that's one common criticism of the iStep exam. Others are about the delay in delivering results. Teachers in schools often do not know their student scores until months after the exam when the academic year is over. In recent years, the exam became computer-based. Technological problems set the exam back even further. Now, some administrators are saying iStep is no longer a reliable measure of student learning. Representative Robert Benning says the bill addresses these issues. iLearn will be shorter and results will come back sooner. And he says teachers will not be evaluated by the results.
State does not mandate what level of involvement by the iLearn or iStep is used in that evaluation. It is really determined at a local level and has been since Senate Bill 1 passed in 2011.
The bill moves on to the Indiana Senate. If it passes, iLearn will begin in the 2018-2019 school year.
The number of Hoosiers earning workforce certificates has jumped significantly. Workforce certificates can be earned in about a year. They require technical training. According to a report by the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, almost 12,000 Hoosiers earned certificates last year. That number is more than twice the number of certificates earned in 2011. The Commission's Communications Project Manager, Kaylee Showers, says the spike is evidence that 2 and 4 year degrees are not for everyone.
There are a lot of jobs out there that are middle skill, but also good paying jobs that require a certificate. So I'd like to think that we're getting the word out about these certificate programs. And more students are saying, hey, you know, this seems like a good idea or a good fit for me. I'm going to take that path.
Indiana aims for 60% of its residents to obtain a degree beyond high school by 2025. According to Showers, the current higher education attainment rate is 41%.
I think we can get there, and I think this is focused on you know, on certificates and on those middle skill jobs that are out there is really, you know, the way to push that. We can't neglect our 2 and 4 year degree earners, obviously, but I think it's important to you know, let everyone know, or let students out there know, that, you know, there are options if they don't want a 2 or 4 year degree.
The commission is working with Governor Eric Holcomb and the Department of Workforce Development. House Bill 1008 is currently being considered, and with it is the new Workforce Ready Grant. If passed, this grant would cover the cost of adults pursuing certificates in high-demand areas. Showers said that as the baby boomer generation gets older, there is a higher demand for caretakers. According to the commission, more than half of the certificates awarded in 2016 were in business or health-related programs.
The Department of Homeland Security has released a set of memos to implement President Trump's plan to crack down on immigrants who are in the country illegally. The memos order all Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents to aggressively pursue deportation of all undocumented immigrants they encounter. The memos continue the policy of prioritizing immigrants convicted of crimes. However, they also make it clear that CBP and ICE agents are expected to detain and begin deportation proceedings against all undocumented immigrants. The only exception is members of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, started under President Obama. That program, serving over 750,000 young people, provides protection against deportation for undocumented immigrants brought into the country as small children. The memos will end the practice of catch and release, in which nonviolent immigrants are released from detention and ordered to appear at a future court date. Instead, President Trump wants all immigrants caught by border agents, violent and nonviolent alike, to be detained until their court date. To that end, Trump has ordered the construction of more detention centers along the southern border. CBP and ICE agents will also have the authority to send some detainees to Mexico, whether they are actually Mexican or not. Previously, deportees from other Central American countries had to be flown back to their country of origin. Finally, the memos direct Immigrations and Customs Enforcement to create a new office to publicize crimes committed by immigrants. Immigrants will now be exempt from the Federal Privacy Act, and ICE intends to make detailed information about their cases public. Funding that used to be spent advocating for undocumented immigrants will be redirected to the new office, known as VOICE.
And lastly, we have an update on a WFHB News investigation. The Bloomington Police Department is holding on to records that could help the public better understand the effects of a new surcharge for police videos. It's been more than 6.5 weeks since WFHB News requested records that would show who is requesting copies of body and dash camera footage. The request is part of a larger project looking at the effects of Bloomington's new $150 fee for copies of police videos. But after 47 days, it's still not clear when the police department will respond. That's according to an email from the department's records division supervisor, Joan Manning. Local departments generally respond to public information requests in a few days or at most a few weeks. But in an email, Manning says that the police department, which had a $12.6 million budget last year, has been delayed in its response because of the departure of an intern. She wrote, quote, "This type of request is something that our intern would help pull all of the individual reports from our system. However, our intern moved on to other things January 1st, unquote. She says a new intern starts at the end of this month, but will require training before filling the request, meaning that it may take more than 2 months for the city to begin processing the information, which is unlikely to include more than a few dozen pages of information. Indiana law requires public agencies to provide records in a, quote, reasonable amount of time, but there is no specific limit. Other states do have specific rules. In Nebraska, for example, records have to be provided in just 4 days. Other states, like California, prohibit agencies from using excuses such as being short-staffed or having other priorities. This most recent delay at the BPD comes after months of police department officials not answering questions about the $150 fee, which the city council approved in the summer. Captain Steve Kellums referred questions to the city legal department, who referred questions back to the police. Lieutenant Brad Seifers initially promised to, quote, have someone look into questions about how the department provides videos to the public, but Seifers later referred questions back to Kellums, who did not respond. Manning, the Records Division director, spoke briefly with the reporter over the phone, but said she would need permission from Kellums to do a recorded interview. That permission was apparently never granted. This overall lack of information about the police means that more than 7 months after the city adopted a dramatic increase in their video fees, we still don't know how that money is going to be spent. We don't even yet know if anyone will actually pay that much for a copy of a police video. That's a $150 fee. So far, our searches for information have turned up no one who actually paid that fee. And that points to the larger question that WFHB News has been asking as we seek information from the city, and that's whether the primary effect of this fee, intentional or not, will be to simply discourage Bloomington residents from watching what their law enforcement officers are doing. Stay tuned to the Daily Local News for updates on that story. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
And I'm Don Guerra. Indiana nonprofits are lobbying state legislators on two Senate bills that would impact the ability of Hoosiers to receive SNAP benefits. That's the federally funded Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. Feeding Indiana's Hungry, the Indiana Association of United Ways, the Indiana Township Association Incorporated, and the Institute for Working Families are among a dozen organizations working toward the passage of Senate Bill 154, which would remove an asset limit on SNAP recipients, and Senate Bill 9, which would allow certain drug offenders to receive benefits. Reporter Sarah Vaughn spoke with Jessica Fraser, the director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, about why these bills are important and their chances of getting passed.
Jessica, can you talk to me about Senate Bill 154 that addresses asset limits for SNAP recipients?
Senate Bill 154, authored by Senator Merritt, is a bill that will eliminate the asset test on the nutrition assistance program in Indiana. In Indiana, the asset test is $2,250 for like everyday working age folks, and then it is, I think, $1,000 more than that for senior citizens. And we have been concerned about the asset test at the Institute for quite some time. We've been working on this issue because we find there's a cliff in nutrition assistance where people are no longer eligible at 130% of the federal poverty guidelines, and yet they're not self-sufficient until kind of at least 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. And so this leaves them vulnerable to food insecurity or making difficult choices about, am I going to pay for food, or am I going to pay for my rent, or am I going to pay for my, you know, whatever else the other item might be.
So the most recent version of this bill moves the asset limit.
It just eliminates the test altogether. It takes the asset limit out completely. And part of the reason for that is that the test is administratively burdensome. We looked at the data that the state put out, and they had done the asset test with 600,000 unique applications in 2015, and only had 1,400 applications where people were over the asset limit. So that's 0.4%. Additionally, all the stuff that the intake workers have to know in order to be able to administer the test is like 68 pages long, the policy manual. It gets kind of complicated in some areas. Even though people don't often have these assets, they still have to know how to evaluate them. It just seems like there's not enough people who have low enough incomes to qualify for SNAP benefits and high enough assets to sort of be worth all the effort that we put into trying to test that particular piece of eligibility.
Your institute has also referred to a situation that creates churn, as you call it, where people who receive SNAP might get a temporary gift from a relative, or they might pick up a few extra shifts at work or do some extra temp work that puts them over the asset limit for a few months, and then they have to reapply. And that contributes to that administrative cost, I understand. But do you have any numbers as to how much extra that continual reapplication costs the state?
We're at $1 million in state funds just to keep a very, very small amount of people from getting federal food aid that's federal money anyway.
There's also this issue that if assets are keeping folks from receiving SNAP, that puts a burden on local food banks and nonprofit organizations. But how reliable are they in filling the gap that not getting SNAP creates?
I mean, I can't speak specifically to reliability. I'd have to pass you off to some of our food bank friends. But that is why both sort of the township folks and the Feeding Indiana's Hungry have supported this effort in the past. You can't fill all of your needs in a month from a food bank. It's not possible. And then folks will often go to township trustees to fill in the gaps, or they'll just go to, or they go hungry and they pay the heating bill instead of buying food.
Are there other states nearby that have removed that asset limit, and how are they faring?
35 states and the District of Columbia have already eliminated the SNAP asset test, and then an additional set of states have increased the asset level. The one downside to increasing the asset level is that, you know, you still have the administrative burden of all the paperwork and everything. Michigan is the only one of our neighbors that has a higher per case administrative cost than we do. And they are an interesting example because they eliminated the asset test and then they put it back with a higher limit. And when they put it back with a higher limit, that's when their administrative cost per case actually went up above ours. Absolutely. So our administrative cost per case per month in 2015 was $28.92, whereas Michigan's is $29.35, and all of our other neighbors are between $16 and $23 per case. I haven't heard too much from the folks that are just sort of anti-SNAP altogether, but I have heard some concern from folks that it's well-intentioned, that they are afraid that people who have a lot of assets will get the program, and that sort of, in their mind, takes away from people who are more vulnerable. But I think that when you look at how much we're spending, there just aren't enough people that are low income and high asset to make it worth the cost. You know, the average issuance per individual is $119 a month. So we are putting a very expensive alarm system over what is essentially not a very big amount of food. The SNAP program, it's intended as a safety net. It's intended that when people fall on hard times, they take advantage, you know, they enroll in the program, it helps them with a short-term need, and then they sort of bounce right back to where they were. Alternatively, if we ask people to liquidate their entire lives and change their lifestyle, you've put them in a different place where now they are genuinely impoverished. And are they going to be able to bounce back from whatever hardship has befallen them that led them to be income eligible for SNAP in the first place? That's another concern we have.
Let's talk now about Senate Bill 9, which was co-authored by our Senator Mark Stoops. According to your legislative update, this bill would have Indiana opt out of the federal law that bans folks with past felony drug convictions from receiving SNAP benefits. That ban goes back to about 1996 and the federal war on drugs.
Right. Any other type of felony is eligible for SNAP upon their release from prison, but drug felons in Indiana are subject, for the most part, to a lifetime ban. And it's just kind of this weird thing where we are continuing to punish this one type of offender after they have served their time for the rest of their life, and it's food. I haven't been the one doing all sort of the big effort on this bill, but what we've brought to the table is some data around low-income folks that have returned. And on average, they earn about $10,000 a year and only work about half the year. So they are already in sort of a vulnerable position of coming home and trying to earn a living so that they can, you know, stay out of prison and have a life. And we really think that allowing them to have nutrition assistance is part of helping them return and be members of the community.
Is there any real evidence that you know of that, for example, drug offenders have a higher recidivism rate than any other offenders who would be eligible for SNAP once released?
No, we've not seen any data that this deters anybody from anything. And, you know, in fact, we think that, and again, this hasn't been studied yet either, although more and more states are eliminating their ban. So maybe we could start to do some research and comparing states that don't have the ban with states that do. But there's no evidence that suggests that keeping them away from SNAP does anything beneficial at all. I think we have a really good chance on Senate Bill 9. We've been talking to as many of the lawmakers as we can, and I am pretty confident that it has the votes to go through on Senate Bill 9. Most of the lawmakers that I have spoken with are supportive of Senate Bill 9. They see this as part of, you know, the state has gone, is making a lot of effort to try to, you know, change drug policies, do some decriminalizing and providing more support for treatment. Senator Merritt will talk about his, you know, the 5-year plan to kill heroin in Indiana. They see this as part of that whole effort.
Reporting for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
Bill 154 and SB 9 are both eligible for a final vote in the Senate this week. The bills would then move to the House of Representatives for consideration.
Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Coming up next, WFHB's weekly community resources segment, Everyday People.
Welcome to Everyday People, improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County.
Everyday resources for everyday people. Connecting our community by sharing resources you need, want, and probably don't know about.
Hi, this is Stacy, and today we have Carrie Conway with Area 10. Welcome, Carrie.
It's so wonderful to be here, Stacy and Courtney. Thank you for having me.
Sure, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit? We know Area 10 is a huge organization, but can you tell us a little bit about what Area 10 does?
We are a very large organization. We have a very diverse palette of services that we provide. But the very heart of what we are, we're an aging and disability resource center. So if you are a family member or a friend is experiencing any issue related to aging or to physical disability, we are your first call to get hooked up to the services and supports you need in order to live a very fulfilling life. Probably one of our most important programs is just helping people navigate the Medicare maze to figure out which kind of program is going to be best for you.
And Area 10 does that free of charge, right?
Oh, absolutely.
As far as Area 10, what are some of the maybe unknown challenges that your clients deal with?
One of the issues that I have seen that is really, in my 8 years at Area 10, that I have seen just increase is that we have very, very large numbers of socially isolated elderly women in our community, both in Monroe and Owen County, both in urban and rural settings, although predominantly rural. Through no fault of their own, you know, the one thing that all seniors have in common is they all experience loss.
Right.
And, you know, women do live longer than men.
True.
And often, you know, we find women in situations where they've lost their spouse, their children, if they had them, moved away.
Right.
And their minister has moved on to another church. Their neighbors have gone into a long-term care facility or moved to Maryland to be closer to their children. There's a lot of reasons why women have become more isolated.
I like that you mentioned that women in urban and rural settings.
Yes.
I know when I did work for Area 10 that I spoke with women who had moved into a more urban space in the hopes that they would be able to connect with neighbors, but they found that that wasn't necessarily the case.
Getting those folks connected to a companion on a regular basis, a visit or a phone call once or twice a week, you know, they may not qualify for in-home services, but, I mean, let's face it. I mean, I am a woman of a certain age, as you can tell by my experience highlights. I know you can't see that on the radio.
They're lovely.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's getting harder and harder for me to get down on my knees and scrub the tub. Okay. It is not what it was even 10 years ago. It's a major issue for me to do that now. And, you know, I can push a vacuum cleaner for a while, but after about an hour, and it takes me about 2.5 hours to do the house, I'm pretty much done.
Right.
So if we have a program called Caring Companions that basically You know, it's like eHarmony for older adults. We match up volunteers with older folks who have become socially isolated, and they stop by once or twice a week, maybe give a call now and then. And, you know, they'll do some errands, you know, like scrubbing the tub or maybe running the vacuum cleaner, and maybe stop by and pick up their medication on the way over, maybe do a little grocery shopping. Mm-hmm.
So if someone were needing services, what do they do? Do they call Area 10?
Absolutely.
And what happens then?
You know, you just call Area 10. We have folks who are answering the phone who are trained to do an interview process. Because a lot of times when people call and they just say, you know, I really need to have food delivered. Well, as it turns out, they need to have food delivered because there are some underlying issues. Mm-hmm. And we bring that out in conversation.
So I'm sure a burning question for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I had always wanted to know, and now I do know a lot about this. How is all this funded, and how can we help?
We have a large range of state, federal, and private funds, but more and more we're becoming dependent on those private funds and those individual donations. Every year, we have a benefit breakfast for Area 10, and our benefit breakfast this year will be May 3rd, and you can give me a call at 812-876-3383 if you're interested in attending.
Thanks for joining us on Everyday People.
Tune in next week for more information and resources that connect everyday people to everyday resources. For WFHB, I'm Courtney Stewart.
And I'm Stacey Goffinet.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jared Dill, Kate O'Rourke, and Sheila Raghavandran. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Everyday People is produced by Courtney Stewart and Stacey Goffinet. Our engineer is Matt Griffin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. For WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news at WFHB.org.